Hello everyone, I'm Harry Bucknell. Thank you for downloading this podcast from ABF, the Soldiers' Charity. In this edition of General Talk, we break away from the everyday of military life to take an oblique look at the work of the war artist, whose job over the centuries has been to depict the victories, defeats, achievements, and routine of the Army's many regiments throughout history and across the globe. And in recording these events, so create imagery that hangs on the walls of barracks the land over to remind and inspire the men and women who serve today over the illustrious and not-so-illustrious deeds of their forebears. Over the years, some of Britain's most talented painters have picked up the war artist's mantle, including the likes of Augustus John, Anna Airey, Edward Ardizzone, Evelyn Dunbar, and latterly, Linda Kitson and Arabella Dorman. To talk about the work, my guest on the programme is Nick Bashall, arguably one of Britain's finest portrait painters. Originally from Zimbabwe, he won a blue for boxing at Cambridge, where he read law, but at 26, a motorbike accident changed his life forever. By 35, having saved up enough money, he set off for the island of Majorca to train as an artist under the watchful eye of the Spanish master Joachim Turrentiado. From Glastonbury to the salons of the rich and famous, to the drill squares and war zones of the latter-day British Army, Bashall is the master of his craft, having followed the parachute regiment from Aldershot to Kosovo, Iraq and Afghanistan. Painting, he says, is an animal thing. You catch the strength of the faces that communicates down the generations. I caught up with Nick late at night after a long day working on a new group portrait for the officers of the Household Cavalry Mounted Regiment at Hyde Park Barracks. I hope you enjoy the programme. Why did you leave the law so late?
Well, you know, when I was 26, I had a really bad motorcycle accident when I was working for this law firm.
That's when you, when effectively you had to learn to retrain from your right hand to your left hand to work.
Yeah, so the right arm was paralysed in the accident, and they were going to amputate my leg, and the neck was broken. All this, I had a broken bone in my neck and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And I was hospitalised and didn't go to work for nearly a year. And I went from 16 and a half stone to 11 stone. And when I walked into the law office that I'd been working in for 2 years prior to that, they didn't even know who I was. I was unrecognisable.
Yeah.
And so I don't think you realise at the time how traumatic it is, or not traumatic, but how much you have to adapt to this new self, you know. And I suppose part of, I suppose, when you come that close to snuffing it, you know, you're just so happy to be alive. I was ecstatic to be alive.
And then
as a result of that, you sort of reevaluate things. And so when I was in hospital, the first thing I did when I came was conscious and came and had a break from the morphine, I asked for a pencil and paper, because I knew I'd never use my arm again, although they were thinking it might just be sort of numbed. And I drew the guy in the bed opposite with pencil, you know, barely able to, with my left hand, and I thought, yeah, I can do this. And I put pencil and paper to one side, and I thought then that's where the next step is going to be. But it took years to make enough money to be able to then go and get a proper training. And I just thought, well, I've got enough of a brain, but I can't be what I thought I was going to be. I don't really care anymore. I just care that I'm alive. And I just don't care.
Did you find it throwing off the trappings of sort of corporate life, the suits, the Brooks Brothers shoes, the ties, the shirts? Was that easy to do, wasn't it?
Well, I was only a young lawyer. I mean, I didn't have any of the trappings of wealth or anything, you know. I aspired to them before the accident, but after the accident, it didn't matter anymore.
When did you first get the call to sort of get to become a war artist?
It wasn't something that I deliberately aimed to do. It was something, I owe that entirely to my first cousin's wife.
This is General James Bashel, who's...
His wife,
president of the Royal British Legion, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and he's got this amazing wife, Sarah Lucy, who's an eye surgeon. And she called me up one day out of the blue and said, the parachute regiment is looking for a Colours Parade painting. They have selected an artist, but it hasn't been approved yet by the generals. And I think you're better than the one that has been selected. Why don't you apply? So I put in an application, a written application, and I'd done my research on war paintings. So, you know, I was organized. I put in an application. It was in writing. No other artists had done that. And I said that I would do it in public. I'd paint everybody from life, and it would just be a fun exercise. And the generals obviously liked that approach, and I got the job.
Do you think that when you're painting a big picture, like a Colours Parade, you've got lots of different characters you've got to get in, what are the different challenges you face from painting, say, the burghers of the City of London?
Well, my primary objective is always to record the faces, because it's to record the characters for posterity. And there's something kind of that lasts in an oil painting beyond a photograph. Mm. And a sort of group photograph doesn't really have the same impact necessarily. Sometimes it may do. But a painting is such a sort of animal thing, you know, and you catch the strength of the faces, and that's what is always my dominant motivation. I want people to walk in and see the faces and think, oh God, I know, you know, not I know that person now, but in a generation or two's time, they'll look at that general or whatever it is and think, my God, he looks an amazing person, or he's got such a strong face, or he's got a kind face, or whatever it is, you know, and that communicates down the generations. I think if you can paint it well enough to do that, then you've achieved a lot.
And you really, your relationship with the military is forged through your relationship with the parachute regiment, really. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's where it started, yeah. Mm. Because I did the Colours Parade thing in Aldershot, and most of it was done in the mess of one para, which was a big mess. Mm. And so I put it to them that they could have a big picture, and we had a 13-foot canvas, you know, by 8-foot, and I painted every single one of the 50 people from life. They had to stand and pose, so they were invested in the painting, and they saw it, you know, grow, and it was just a joyous experience. And then one para were then sent out to Kosovo, and the commanding officer was a guy called Paul Gibson, who subsequently got the OBE or MBE and the DSO and stuff, you know, he did well. And he called me up at about 4 in the morning one day and said, by the way, Bashel, we're in Kosovo, can you come out and record this? And so I rang up a friend of mine who was working out there to meet me at Thessalonica Airport. And I just flew out, and he met me there and took me up through Macedonia. And then another friend of mine came down from the Paris of him, and he met me he was the 2IC to Paul Gibson, and he came and picked me up from Macedonia, took me to, and then I walked into Paul Gibson's office, and you know, and he just couldn't believe that I was there, but it was just,
and that of course
just fun, you know, it was just
a great adventure, I suppose.
It was an adventure.
There was a sort of romance about the official war artist. In the Falklands Wars, Linda Kitson, who was and there's a certain onus on you. Why does the military like to record its war by charcoal and by oil?
I think it's actually an accident of history in a way. And I read a book, a wonderful book, about history painting, the painting of history, by a man who was the president of the National National Gallery. He was a fantastic writer, and he talked about how history painting, the painting of history, was the number one genre of painting up until the end of the 19th century. So, you know, if you go to the National Gallery, you'll see all these wonderful paintings of historic events, you know. The most powerful of which, my favourite painting, you know, the most powerful to me is the picture of Lady Jane Grey about to be executed. Mm. And in many ways they forged an understanding amongst the British people, for example, of their own history. Because like Hogarth, you know, hundreds of prints were made. Mm. So people saw, you know, as they say, you know, the human brain remembers things in images rather than lines of print in a book. And these are lots and lots of images. And then things changed towards the end of the 19th century, 20th century. It became sort of non, you know, it wasn't done to try and capture your history if you weren't there at the time. So everything had to be original and quite modern. It was a modern thing, and things had to change. It was a good thing. But one of the casualties of that was that the galleries then took down a lot of their history paintings, the paintings of our country's history, and other countries did the same. And they destroyed a lot of the prints, you know? And so history painting was then relegated to a minor role. Previously it was the most important, above landscape and portraiture and everything else. And history was often recorded in military terms, because so many of the events in history were events that were forged on the battlefield. Those paintings were recorded in history, and the army had always done it, not just here, but in Germany and France and most of the countries in Europe. But for it was therefore a tradition, and if you go to any British army mess, you'll see history painted on all the paintings on the walls, you know, and they're not photographs in many cases, they're paintings. Mm. And those that tradition carried on in the British Army. Mm. And it was almost an accident of history.
But I suppose it creates a culture going forward.
Yeah,
too.
Yeah.
When you go to somewhere like, you take a campaign, like say Kosovo, you've got to record it, you've got to get a feel for it. How do you set about your brief, as it were?
It's just talking to people. I mean, I didn't know much about the history. I read up about it. I bought a book on it to find out, you know, what had happened in the past. Mm. I do think there's almost an onus on you to know what's gone before, particularly if you're going to record the present.
Yeah.
And I've always loved history, so it was a very privileged position for me to be in, to be able to record it. So, yeah, that was pretty relevant.
Presumably, you have to get a sense of the scope of the operation. So, in that case, you had armed brigades and all manner of kit and material out there. But you also had General Mike Jackson was commanding the whole thing. You created that marvellous picture of him in his headquarters when he's negotiating with the Kosovans. And how did you stumble across that moment?
Well, I went out there with one para. General Mike was the sort of big dog, you know, running the whole show. And the two I see in one para was a guy called Jim Coventry Sims, to whom I owe a lot. Anyway, he said to me, Mike Jackson's coming, the paras are leaving in 2 days. Nick, I tell you what, put up your painting and put up the photographs of you painting. Because I did it amongst, you know, I did it from life on the streets, you know, so a lot of Kosovans were just absolutely riveted as to what the hell we were doing there, you know, with all the guys standing there and some, you know, eccentric man painting them. Anyway, so I put the picture on the stairways. Jackson had to walk past, and he saw the photographs of me painting there, and he looked at me and he said, Bashar, because I met him before when I did the parachute regiment thing, because he was a para. And he said, what are you doing here? I I said, and I just sort of, with a smile, I said, I'm just painting, sir. And he just went, and then carried on. And the next day I got a call from his MA, military assistant, saying, General wants to see you. Which was as Coppinger Simms had anticipated, and I went up there, and he said, right, we're meeting the KLA, you know, in a couple of hours. I want you to record this. So I had a couple of hours to sort of, you know, bloody hell, you know. And so then I, you know, one of the great army things is, you know, local resources, you know, just use, think on your feet. And so I said, have you got any sort of, you know, lectern or something? Yeah, there's a lectern here, you can use that. Have you got any big paper? Yeah, we do have big, you know, sketchbooks or so on to deliver lectures. So, okay, can I borrow that? And I stood there at the back of the hall of this. It was an old sort of place where they trained. It was a film school built by the Russians. So there were big old-fashioned, you know, air conditioning things.
Yeah.
And I stood at the back there, and the meeting took place with General Mike and, you know, the French Foreign Minister Kouchner, and he was the head of the UN delegation, and then all the Kosovan leaders and our guys, and then all the NATO heads and so on, you know, and their ADCs and so on. And I had to draw it. So I drew them just to get their proportions. I did a general picture, you know, but there was no detail. And then I then painted in the film studio the background over a period of days, and you know, meetings took place in there, and you know, the artists were just standing in the back, you know. And then one by one, I painted the individuals into the picture, you know, as we said for the Queen, you know, and they got nothing from it. But then they got these individual portraits, and that was they just loved that.
But you repeated that again in Iraq and Afghanistan. There are images of you with Land Rovers out there, sort of guarding you and soldiers around you while you paint in the streets. And especially in Afghanistan, that must have been quite unnerving. Did you? I mean, you were conscious that you were doing a bit of somewhat of a stunt to get him. But you were at risk.
We were set on by a crowd, and we had to take a back route quite quickly. But I think the Afghans, you know, they just thought, what is going on? So when I was painting on the street, there'd be, you know, 100 guys standing watching, or 50 guys, you know, Afghans, and I've got some amazing footage that CNN took as they came past. They just couldn't believe it. And you see in that footage, they filmed it, and you see the Afghans, these wonderful faces of the Pathans, you know, with, they all looked like Imran Khan, they all looked like warriors, you know, handsome as anything.
Yeah.
And they're looking at the canvas, and they're looking down the street to see what you're painting, and they're looking back. They were totally, you know, captivated by this bizarre spectacle. They all thought I was, my interpreter, I didn't know until afterwards, told them that I was a general, and, you know, that I was just, this is my hobby.
Did you find something sort of recording out in Afghanistan with these wonderful, images and so on, the tribesmen and so on? Did you find that something almost Kipling-esque? There's a responsibility to record. Did you find that that was a pressure to you to get it right? And were you harking back to those 19th century times of...
No. I'd worked in Pakistan as a lawyer.
Mm.
And, you know, with the people of Pakistan and Afghanistan, and, you know, there's a considerable overlap. So I'd been in Pakistan a lot as a lawyer.
Mm.
And I sort of... So Afghanistan was very similar. And, you know, they're very proud, and but they're curious, you know. I mean, and the thing about it also was that, you know, when that whole conflict, you know, sort of broke open after the Russians walked in and so on, you know, then they hadn't been educated for decades, you know. Nobody could go to school, so they were a largely uneducated population. But that didn't make them, you know, any less clever than anybody else. They were, you know, you could see these really warlike, clever faces, and they were intrigued by the process, you know, And that was, it was such a privilege to be, to be there.
But you talk about the privilege. You followed the army on operations from Kosovo to Iraq and then into Afghanistan. How did you see the men and the operations and the manner of operations change in different theatres as time wore on?
It depended on the level of security. I mean, Afghanistan was not dangerous, particularly, nor was Kosovo. Iraq was more so. It was more unpredictable. I mean, there was one occasion when I was painting in the souk, Basra. Mm. I thought I was only going to be working in the sort of military camp, and I didn't realize that I was going to go right out into the. So I was standing there painting, and that was slightly dangerous because in the souk next door, in literally a street away, a 15-year-old kid had thrown some hand grenades out and seriously injured some Irish soldiers, you know, and so I didn't know that at the time, and then I said to the sergeant major the next day, I said, well, actually, you know, I could probably do quite a lot of this from photographs, you know. I mean, and he said, no, sir, we've got to, this is business as usual. We have to show that this is business as usual. He was a Welshman. So I was back in the suit the next day and sort of, and my heartbeat was definitely up.
Were you painting in a helmet and a flat jacket?
No, I wouldn't wear any of that because I don't know why. It was just, if they're going to get you, they're going to get you, you know.
Mm. Did you find that you had that soldiers were putting their lives perhaps at risk to protect you while you painted? Did you find that played on your mind at all?
Yeah, I mean, it sort of, I couldn't worry too much about it because the decision was made from higher up. Mm. They wouldn't have sent me out there unless it was safe, and unless there was, you know, sufficient security. And it was also part of, I suppose, you know, the soft, you know, hearts and minds. You know, it's like, you know, this is okay. And in Iraq, it's fascinating because in the old souk, I asked if I could go to the female souk because I thought it would be rather gentler.
Mm.
And while I was standing there painting, you know, loads of people in this low slung, ceilings and so on. And I chose not to stand in front of anybody's stall because it would interrupt the business. Mm. So I stood on a sort of T junction, and there was another narrow alley to my left. And I felt definitely sort of slightly exposed because, you know, 20, 30 yards down, there was a whole bunch of houses and somebody could pick me off from there. And I felt for some time that I was being watched. And so my heartbeat was definitely up. And somebody then came. And it happened to be when James Mates was, you know, he was a well-known journalist. He happened to be interviewing. And then suddenly out of the blue, this guy walked up and he had a roll of something in his hand. It was a roll of paper. And he opened it out, and it was a drawing of me. So they had been watching me, not to shoot me,
yeah,
but to draw me.
It was a good drawing.
Because it was part of the, oh, it was great, I still got it. It's a wonderful drawing.
Yeah.
And it turned out that part of the old souk was part of where the French, when they were there for a while, it was the sort of artistic centre. It's just, you know.
There are, whenever there are operations, you've got a job to do. There's tension. There's often things are happening at speed. How do you reflect that in your work to show the urgency, the danger, the stress that the soldiers and soldiery are under at the time?
I don't think I necessarily achieved that. I mean, I think I was at my strongest when I was painting from life on the streets. And by definition, the army would not have allowed me to do that unless they thought it was secure. So, and unless they thought it was a good thing for, you know, the locals to see that we weren't there just to pull the trigger. We were there also because we respected their culture and we were painting it, you know? So those were done, they looked like sort of peaceful things. I mean, the buildings were often destroyed, bombed and so on, and people were starting businesses in those buildings, and there were soldiers standing there, you know, that I painted, talking to the people, the local people. And it was a peaceful thing. I had to do a few sort of recreations of action, which by definition you had to make up, and you know, I paint the people from life, but I wasn't there, so I'm not sure any of those pictures were particularly convincing.
You've got one of a female soldier coming up, and there's a casualty on the ground.
Kate Nesbitt. Won the highest award for a British soldier, a female soldier.
But it's a very striking image.
Ah. So you never know how people see your images. You don't know how people see your work.
You didn't emphasise her femininity. You just emphasised her present as a soldier coming up. How did you approach that?
Well, I did my research. I spoke to the people who were there. Yeah, basically, they'd been pinned down in open ground, the soldiers, and one of them was wounded, and they needed a medic to save his life. And the officer nearby drew around for a medic, and there was Kate. And she then, you know, had to run across open ground under fire and dive into this very shallow, dent in the ground where these guys were hidden, as it were, and administer life-saving medicine. So I then recreated the scene in this studio, and then painted Kate from life, you know. And
you sound as if you weren't too sure about the composition of that. What was your misgivings about that picture?
No, there were no misgivings. You know, my duty was to, and my desire was to recreate the scene. So I needed to get information as to how, you know, what happened, and then as close as I could, you know, recreate it.
What was your impression when you met her?
She was so modest, just kind. You know, nothing had gone to her head at all. I mean, just somebody who was there and did her job and just had the courage to just do it. None of us ever know how we're going to react in a situation like that.
No.
She probably didn't.
Do you feel a great pressure when you're painting these, recording these paintings?
No. Oddly enough, maybe I should, but it's, you know, I had the training, I, you know, to be able to put it into a visual image, recreate history in a way that they all used to do in the old days, using the skill that I've been taught and trained at and learned how to do. And it's just a, you know, it's just a branch of the visual arts, and I really feel it's a consuming desire to represent what happened historically. I don't sort of try and glorify it or you know, or romanticize it, because it's brutal, but it's just ordinary human beings in a situation where we have to deal with it. And I find it so impressive, and people are just, you know, they're principled almost invariably. But modest.
I'd like to now talk about this great canvas we have in front of us here, which we, while we're sat in your wonderful studio, can you just describe, how long is this canvas that we're looking at?
It's 3.5 metres wide. It's a metre tall. It follows a precedent. I mean, again, it's history.
Yeah.
It's a tradition.
So this painting is of the House of Cavalry Mounted Regiment in Knightsbridge. The original painting was done in 1857, is that correct?
Yeah.
And there have been subsequent paintings, the last one being done by Lucy Pragnell in 2010. In the earlier portraits, there were subliminal messages by various officers, if they were facing each other or not facing each other. in this particular composition, are there some subliminal messages that someone was unpopular or whatever?
In the 1857 one, there was. The commanding officer was sort of sidelined to he wasn't that popular, and the guy who paid for the picture was a young subaltern, you know, who was a wealthy man, and he stands right in the centre. In this case, looking at previous paintings in history, you know, group paintings, I sort of came up with a composition and then left it to them to decide where people would go. And so the groups that they are in are groups of friends. Mm. And in the middle is the commanding officer and the captain, who is it? So both of them won the Military Cross, both in very brave, sets of circumstances.
And the House of Cavalry has a sort of reputation for creating these great tableaus of officers and so on.
It's just down to the personalities. You know, the young officers wanted to do it. And, these are powerful men. These are strong characters, you know. They are clever, and they're physically at the sort of height of their powers, if you like, you know. And many of them were going to Sibley Street, and I suspect do very well. And they decided.
How many sitters have you got in the hole?
I think it's 32.
So that each one has to come in here to be painted. Yeah.
Normally they'd come in a group, and so they, you know, after a while they'd forget you were there.
You clearly have enjoyed engaging with them.
Yeah.
Do you feed off their energy? Their
youth? Yeah. These are young guys. You know, I feel like it energizes you. You have to, you know, and they take the mick big time. It's a real British Army thing, you know. There's nowhere to hide.
Yeah.
There's nowhere to hide if you're a soldier in the British Army, because you know your people so well. They know you. Mm. They know your strengths and they know your weaknesses. And what's great about it is that they support you and your strengths, and they take the mick out of your weaknesses, but they support you. It's a most fantastic sort of, you know, assembly of people, because they know that their lives depend on each other. You know, they'll take the mick, but they don't belittle. Mm.
Every picture must have a challenge, but this particularly, with its such great variety, what is the greatest challenge for this?
It's purely mechanical, in the sense that I didn't want them just to be in a line like the ones that you've seen.
Yeah.
I wanted some people in the background, some in the foreground, some in the middle ground. And so the people furthest away are the smallest, and the people nearby are much bigger. You calculated to work out just how much smaller somebody would be, you know, further away from somebody nearby. I can't do it with photographs. And you just basically, you eyeball it. You know, we're animals, you know, you immediately sense if something's wrong. And some of those faces, I realised they're too big or too small, and so I've painted one or two of them several times.
Kinnear had his mouse. Do you put a little signature somewhere in there?
When I was painting that first big picture of the parachute regiment, I got had a few drinks in the mess that night, and I thought, well, actually, I'll give them my own insignia. And I did, on the reflection of somebody's shoe, which was, you know, the black shoe, it always got a white highlight. I turned that highlight into tiny nude, and just as a gas.
So would you have a stunt like that for
the 12th?
Yeah.
No. I was younger then, you know.
But I think that your work accurately reflects the mood and the spirit of what goes on and what has gone on.
I don't know how people see what I do, but I feel so privileged to have been part of it.
Well, Nick, they keep coming back for more, so thanks so much for being my guest today on General Talk.
Well, thank you for having me.
And my thanks once again to Nick Bashell. His work can be viewed at nickbashell.com. Or to see displays of paintings by war artists, visit the Imperial War Museum, details at iwm.org.uk. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast and would like to learn more about the work of the Soldiers' Charity or to take part in its many events, please visit soldierscharity.org. And from me, Harry Bucknell, farewell and thank you for listening. with editing by Michael Stigliano, this podcast has been a Gamekeeper production for ABF, the Soldiers Charity.